I'm really excited about being here tonight. This is a subject that I am absolutely passionate about. I want to work to protect our children. I'm excited to have the opportunity to talk with you tonight about how you can work to do that. And having this discussion is the first step in how we will protect our kids. When I was writing this talk, it was a little hard for me because I love to start my talks with a little bit of humor, and I absolutely couldn't think of anything funny about this subject. So it's just not a subject that you can make light of. It's a difficult subject, and it's hard to hear. It's kind of like that train wreck scenario, right, where you go by it and you don't want to look at it, but your eyes just go there. Well, in this case, you don't want to look there, but you need to look there. You've got to look and listen and learn about this subject so that you can work to avoid that train wreck. And the analogy stops there. I'm not saying a person that has experienced sexual abuse will be a train wreck. It's just that it's a subject that we don't want to think about or talk about, and we have to. So my first thought with this time was like, how am I going to fill the time that they've given me to talk? And as I got into it, writing it more and more, it was like, how am I going to fit it into this time span? There's just so much to say about this subject. Some of you I know, were probably victims of sexual abuse, and perhaps your heart is beating really fast right now, and knowing how that works, you're probably even thinking like, oh, can anyone else tell that I feel this way, that I'm a victim? Because that's the way the shame and the false guilt of sexual abuse works. Or maybe you're a person who's already done your work on your sexual abuse, but even then, it's going to be hard for you to sit here and hear that. It's a difficult subject for everyone, so let me just normalize that for you. And lastly, perhaps you have recently found out that your child has been molested. And when I say that word, I mean sexually assaulted. If you're already filled with worry about him or her, you're feeling guilty about not protecting your child, we're not trying to guilt you. We're just trying to give you information so that you can move forward. If you know that your child was sexually abused, I encourage you to report it and consider professional help for your child. Even if your child seems fine right now, I think it would be good to have them check in with a professional. And again, if any of these things trigger you, out that door to the room back there on the right. As a licensed professional counselor, I want to tell you there are two things I want you to know. First, that none of my examples tonight are from my counseling sessions. I consider confidentiality way too important to share anything that one of my clients has shared with me. And secondly, I have heard stories that would make your blood run cold, but I'm not here to scare you. I'm not going to say any more than is absolutely necessary to get my point across. I'm not going to share terrible graphic stories of abuse. So I want you to fear not. I'm not going to give you vicarious trauma tonight. So with that said, I thought it would be good if we all just take a deep breath before we get started. So ready? We're going to all breathe in together. Ready? One, two, three, four, and out. Okay. So given the statistics, your child is more likely to be sexually abused than to be hit by a car when crossing the street. So why is it that we spend so much time teaching our children how to cross the street safely, but we never approach this important subject? So why this matters to all of us? There are approximately 42 million survivors of child sexual abuse in the United States alone. And then those are the statistics that Johnny already gave. 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys have suffered some form of sexual abuse before the age of 18. It's children of every gender, age, race, ethnicity, background, socioeconomic status, and family structure are all at risk. No child is immune. Some might say that these numbers are declining, and that would really be great news. But another possible reason for the decline could be differing definitions of sexual abuse, differing reporting standards, and different statistical methods. But regardless of the reality, one child is too many, and if it's your child, it's completely devastating. According to one children's hospital, over 200 children are sexually abused every day in the United States. So let's define sexual abuse. Sexual abuse is unwanted sexual activity with perpetrators using force, making threats, or taking advantage of victims not able to give consent. And by that, I mean any child under the age of 18, because they can't give consent. All sexual touching between an adult and a child is sexual abuse. Sexual touching can be between children can also be sexual abuse when there's a significant age difference between the kids, between the children, or if they're different developmentally. Sexual abuse does not have to involve penetration, force, pain, or even touching. If an adult engages in any sexual behavior, looking, showing, or touching with a child to meet the adult's interests or sexual needs, it is sexual abuse. And this includes the manufacture, distribution, and viewing of pornography. Showing pornography to children is also considered sexual abuse. So if you were talking to your children, here's a good way. You say, sexual abuse is when you are tricked or forced into letting someone touch your private body parts. These are the parts of a body that the bathing suit covers. Sexual abuse is also when someone shows his or her private body parts or tells you to touch them. And that second part of the definition is really important because that's sort of the gateway action of an abuser. And it would also leave lasting feelings of shame. So who is the abuser? Over 90% of abusers are known, loved, and or trusted by the child. 40% of those abusers are older children or adolescents. Only 10% of abused children become perpetrators, and less than 2% of those are women. But 90% of abusers were once victims of abuse. So of that 90% of abusers that the child knows, 30 to 40% are family members, 50 to 60% are trusted non-family members, like babysitters, family friends, child care providers, or neighbors, and 10% are strangers. So this is not about stranger danger in most cases. I know this is very disturbing information. I'm sure some of you just got a pit in your stomach. You're worrying and wondering about people you trust. But you must trust with your eyes wide open. Don't be naive. Prepare your children and then live your life with this knowledge tucked away in your brain. It's very important that you use your intuition. If you get any weird feelings about anyone, your gut is usually right. If you feel uncomfortable about one of your child's friend's older brother, you're probably right somewhere in that feeling. You should set boundaries with anyone you feel uncomfortable with, and you should definitely do it for your kids. I urge you to use this gut check with everyone, your kids' dentist, their doctors, their coaches, their piano teachers, everyone. And if you get a weird feeling about anyone, immediately set boundaries and or detach from them. You don't have to wait for proof. If you wait for proof that your gut feeling is right, it might be too late for your child. I'm not saying that you have to confront the person or that you have to tell anybody else. Just quietly and assertively trust your intuition. Many years ago, when our now adult daughter was 10 years old, she came to us and said she felt uncomfortable with a male member of our family that she was coming into contact with. And when we tried to dig deeper with her, she assured us that nothing had happened, that she just felt uncomfortable. And we believed her and respected her gut instinct. We monitored her very closely if that person was around. And as she grew up, her discomfort diminished, and nothing ever came of it. But she was right to voice her concerns, and I'm glad that we somehow knew to trust her feelings. We have to teach our children to trust their gut. There is no way of knowing if someone is a predator. Predators are more often than not charismatic, trusting, charming, and appear to be innocent. It's always better to be safe than sorry with your children, and you should never be sorry for trying to protect them. Adults who molest children are often friendly and popular, and sometimes they just seem too good to be true. They may show up to babysit in your hour of need, or give gifts, or be the fun adult who entertains the kids so that the parents can go have fun. Now, granted, those also describe a lot of good people with good intentions. So what's the difference? One thing to watch for is grooming, the relationship an abuser tries to create with a child and often with his or her parents before attempting abuse. So you have to be alert to adults who consistently try to find ways to be alone with children. Maybe someone who bought basketball tickets for that out-of-town game or a conference or a camping trip. Those things might be okay, but on the other hand, they might not. You should avoid one adult to one child interactions whenever possible. A person who unexpectedly gives gifts to a child to win their favor or who try to coerce them to do things they normally wouldn't should raise some warning flags. Someone who uses tricks or jokes or secrets to get children to mistrust their own instincts should be watched very carefully. Once the offender has established sufficient emotional dependence and trust with your child, making them feel special, the offender progressively sexualizes the relationship. It often begins with desensitization, which may occur through talking or pictures or creating situations like going swimming where they might both be naked. At that point, the adult exploits a child's natural curiosity using feelings of stimulation to advance the sexuality of the relationship. So you have to be watchful for unhealthy boundaries, such as an adult calling a child his girlfriend, for example, or singling out one child as special. It sounds harmless, but it's inappropriate and should be a warning flag. People who sexually abuse others often do so to intimidate or manipulate them. Sex should never be an assertion of power over another person, and young people should know that it's not their fault if a trusted adult acts inappropriately. So why don't kids tell? The first is shame, one reason. And shame is different than guilt. When guilt is like you've done a bad thing. Well, shame is this overarching feeling of like, I'm a bad person, okay? They fear that they won't be believed. They fear that they will be blamed, right? It's your fault. If you wouldn't have acted like that, it wouldn't have happened. A fear of loss, that their family, relationships, or environment will change. You know, what's going to happen to the family if mom's boyfriend has to move out? Or what's going to happen to the family if we have to move because of this? Lots of fear of loss, fear of the unknown, and then being threatened. Perpetrators may threaten a pet or a sibling or a parent. I'm going to tell you in a little bit about a young man, Chris, and he said that his grandfather, who sexually abused him, would regularly show him his gun and tell him that he was going to use it if Chris ever told. 9 out of 10 cases of sexual abuse are never reported to authorities. So look carefully at those 6 things. They would be a big deal to any of us, even as adults. Imagine how hard it would be for a child who feels intimidated and guilty and alone to deal with those things. This may be hard to understand, but most children are not forced into sexual abuse. It occurs after the grooming period of extra attention and gifts and favor and trusting. So this is why most children do not go immediately to their parents and report. Even if the parents have talked to them about it, they easily become confused and feel shameful by what's going on, and they are not always likely to run and tell. Sometimes a child might feel confused, especially if they felt any kind of physical pleasure or emotional intimacy from the abuse. Remember, this attention may feel very validating to a child. It makes them feel special or chosen. So these ambivalent feelings can make it difficult for the child to speak up. Sometimes the abuser will convince the child that he or she enjoyed it and they wanted it to happen. So let's consider that your daughter or son is 10 or even 13 years old, and all of a sudden they're getting this extra attention from their friend's older brother. It feels good. It feels validating. She or he certainly isn't going to come running to you if they're getting inappropriate sexual attention. It gets very complicated. They like the attention, at least at first, and they are afraid that you're going to blame them. So there are many understandable reasons why a child victim of sexual abuse is not likely to tell anyone about their abuse. Often the abusive adult will convince the child that they won't be believed or that they are somehow responsible for the abuse and will be punished for it. The child might care and feel protective of the person who sexually abused them. The child may feel they are betraying this person by telling about the sexual contact, and the abuser may use this information to help maintain the secrecy. Remember that often these are family members or people that the child trusts and cares about, so they feel torn. Children frequently remain silent to protect the non-abusive parent from upsetting information. They imagine how mom's going to feel when you tell her it's her father or her brother or something like that, and they worry about the non-abusive parent as well. A child may feel that they permitted the abuse and should have been able to stop it. Remember, there are no situations where a child is responsible for any sexual interaction with a more powerful adult. So when do people finally tell? Hopefully, when they're educated and raised in an open environment, a child would tell a trusted person about their abuse. Sometimes a conversation will help to have a child open up, or sometimes a child will see something on TV or learn something at school that encourages them to tell. But sometimes people stay silent for 20 years or more before telling. The mind is a wonderful thing. It has many protective mechanisms, and sometimes memories are buried so deeply they actually don't remember something happening to them. And then oftentimes one day something happens and it triggers the memory and it just comes flooding in. It could be a place or a TV show, or it could be when the victim's own child now turns the same age that they were when they were abused. So sometimes people have a desire so strong to protect others that they then tell. Whatever, whenever someone tells you, I urge you to believe that person. So believe your child. I can't say this strongly enough. Believe them. Validate their feelings. Validate their feelings. If they are saying something to you, something undoubtedly made them feel uncomfortable. Hear them. They often test the water to gauge your reaction. Saying the unspeakable is just too hard. So sometimes they just throw out a little bone to see how it's going to be received. This is a true example. So my friend's brother, now a grown man, was sexually abused by his grandfather for 7 years. And he said that one time as a child, he just threw out a little bait to see what his parents would say. He said, Grandpa asked me to wake him up, and when I did, he got out of bed naked. And his parents immediately said, oh, some people sleep naked, you know, don't worry about it. And then years later, that same grandpa was accused of sexual abuse of someone else. And the parent asked their son if anything had ever happened to him. And the boy, who was still being abused, said that the man had exposed himself to him once. And the parents replied, oh, good, I'm glad that's all. And that was the end of it. He felt that he had been pushed away. He never said anything again for 20 years. I'm not trying to cast blame on those parents. I'm sure they did what they thought was right. I'm sure they did the best they could. They acted within what they knew. But we have to be careful to listen and follow up with our children. We must make this subject not a forbidden subject. It must be something that we can talk about. Imagine if those parents had followed up with that child, even if it was later and they thought about it, asking him, you know, how he felt when Grandpa got out of bed naked, asking him if anything had ever happened that made him feel uncomfortable. You know, what if they had had the conversation that said, abusers are people we know and they try to trick children? That story would have had a far better outcome. And that young man, by the way, is Chris Carlton, and he has written a book called Nice to Meet Me about his sexual abuse. He went on to be the marketing director of One in Six, an organization that supports men who have experienced sexual abuse. And he went on to use his experiences to help others. So you have to teach your child to keep telling people until somebody listens, whether it's daddy or mommy or a teacher or a doctor. They should keep telling until someone hears them and takes action. Statistically, kids almost never lie about this subject. So that's really important to think about. They almost never lie. If your child tells you something happened, believe them. You should report it to Childline, and the number is either in your brochure or you can easily find it online. You can let them investigate. They are open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and you can even report anonymously. They are trained in this, and they are good at it. But you might also consider reporting to the police at the same time if you do that. But I would say, in either case, once the investigation happened, it's still your, or once you've made a complaint, it's still your job to be your child's advocate. You've got to follow through. You can't just report and forget about it. I think we saw that happen at one of our universities, right? It is your job to follow through and make sure it doesn't fall through the cracks. My advice to you would be, if you reported something and they came back and said they didn't have proof of anything, I would still choose to protect my child and act as if I knew it to be so, in terms of protecting my own child. Reporting is so important. Protecting your own child is obviously, you know, top in your mind, but if you don't report abuse, it will continue, and someone else's child will be abused. You've got to put yourself in the shoes of others and think, like, how would you feel if somebody could have stopped your child from being abused? I think this is a really good example of that saying, it takes a village. So what are the warning signs in our children, and what should we look for? I would add, so these are the behaviors that you might look for. Changes in behavior, reluctance to be alone with the person, night sweats, fear, appetite change, just differences in your child, right? I would add to this slide that in older children, they often become hypersexualized or sexually reactive. They often have issues with promiscuity and poor self-esteem. Are also common in the old, especially you'll see that in the older kids a bit. I was once told by a mother that something happened to her now adult daughter when she was in third grade. She said she became those things on the top row there. And when the mother told me that, I was so sad because I knew that that was the year that her daughter had begun to be sexually abused. But the mother never put it together, right? I often wonder how that girl's life would have been different had she, you know, had her mother figured it out and spoken up, if she would have trusted her instincts about her child. She knew she was sensing something, she just didn't know what it was. MendingTheSoul.org, which works with victims of sexual abuse, says abuse is unique in the way it damages people because it literally wounds the soul. The ravages of abuse are deep-seated and often lifelong. Abuse is one of the most significant sources of emotional, physical, and relational damage. People who were abused as children are more likely to struggle with substance abuse, juvenile delinquency, adult criminal convictions, and psychiatric and mental health problems. The effects of sexual abuse are typically serious and can last a lifetime. But that said, there is hope. A person can experience great healing. In many cases, professional help is necessary to fully process the abuse and the effect it has on somebody's self-image. But a person can experience beauty out of those ashes. I saw a quote on, actually it was on Goodreads. It said, no battle was ever won with silence. And I think that's so relevant to this discussion. Why don't we talk to our children? I know that oftentimes you think, you know, I don't want to strip their innocence away. I don't want to show them, you know, how ugly the world is and about all the violence in the world. It is sad that we would rob them of their innocence, but if we don't, someone else might. So try thinking of these conversations as being just as important, and frankly more important given the statistics, than teaching your child how to cross the road safely. If you don't talk about sexual abuse, your child is more at risk. Not talking about it might also give your child the impression that we just don't talk about these things, right? We don't want them to think this is a subject that's taboo. Having difficult conversations when they are young helps to set the precedent for when they are older that we can talk about anything. The earlier you start talking to your kids, the easier things will be for you later in the game. The most important thing you can accomplish as a parent, or one of the most things, is to be an askable parent, a parent that's approachable. One helpful hint is to get in the habit of saying good question when your kids come to you. That is your moment to think about the answer before you blurt out something silly or negative, right? So point number one in reference to the talk is you have to talk to your kids. Communicate early and often. The second point is teach them the difference in a surprise and a secret. One of the tenets of sexual abuse is secrecy. So it's important to teach your child that secrets are not good. Surprises are fun and make people happy, but secrets are different from surprises. Secrets are not nice and they can make people feel confused or sad. Some families teach that secrets are something that you plan to tell later, giving the child the understanding that they don't keep them forever. Some people like to simply teach that we don't keep secrets about touching. It's a little tricky in terms of young girls, right? They love their secrets. They love secrets about crushes and secrets about what's going on in the playground or whatever. So the point is that we have to teach them to understand secrecy and when it's appropriate. Assure your child that they will not get in trouble for telling you their secret. In the recovery movement, there's a saying that says, secrets keep you sick. And it's so true. Teach your child that we should not harbor secrets. There is a recent study that just came out that says that a mother that was sexually abused has never done her own processing of her abuse has children that will be more likely abused. I believe the number is as high as 85% of children whose mothers were abused that haven't done the work will also be abused. So these secrets have a way of perpetuating themselves. The third thing you want to make sure your kids understand is that they own their own body. At 3 years old, my grandnephew came to visit and he was showing me how to stop, drop, and roll. He had already begun learning about fire safety at three, which was great. But at the same time, are we teaching our children how to keep their bodies safe? Some parents like to use books for these kinds of conversations. And we have a couple of books back in the back that you can look at. I really like the one called God Made All of Me by Justin and Lindsay Holcomb. And this is a quote from that book in terms of talking to your child. It says, God made all of you. Every part of your body is good and some parts are private. He made the parts of your body that other people see every day and he made your private parts. Every part is good because God made every part and called it all good. Some parts of your body are for sharing and some parts are not for sharing. When talking about our bodies, it's important to not create a taboo or dirty feeling about their body parts. Instead, parents can teach their children that their private parts are so special that they're just for them and for no one else, unless someone is helping them keep their private parts clean, safe, or healthy. It is recommended that you teach them the proper names of their body parts. Children need to know that all parts of the body are healthy and are okay to talk about. Some parents teach that just because you ask nicely doesn't mean the other person has to say yes. And just because someone asks you nicely doesn't mean you have to say yes. At first, that mainly covers toys and cookies and, you know, screen time or whatever. But eventually, we hope that your children will make the connection from that to their own bodies. That by the time your child is old enough for sexual consent to be an issue, they will have internalized that they don't have to feel pressured by polite people. Consent has much to do with owning your own body and setting personal boundaries for yourself and for others, and it's an essential element of preventing sexual assault. Learning consent for small children means that if you're tickling your best friend, you have to stop when she says stop, even though you like tickling, right? You have to teach your child that no means no from a young age. Part of owning your own body is letting your child say no to being touched. This begins with the simple things like kiss grandma goodbye. Let your child decide who or what he or she doesn't like and why. Messages such as, oh, don't hurt your uncle's feelings, kiss him goodbye, can be confusing. Teach your child that they don't have to kiss and hug who they don't want to. In the interest of manners, you might teach them something like looking at the person, maybe shaking their hand and saying goodbye politely, but they have to be able to own their own bodies. And in the same vein, don't ask your child to help you maintain your emotions. I'm sad, give me a hug, right? We say that innocently, but it sets up your child to feel responsible for other people's emotions. A perpetrator may use that very line, asking the child to help them feel better. And I know some of you are freaking out right now, thinking, I've done that. It's okay, just don't do it going forward. Teach your child that if someone is making them feel uncomfortable or even feel tingly and nice in their private parts, it's still not appropriate and they should tell you immediately. It's important to not make them wrong or ashamed for having sexual pleasure, since many children do touch themselves. Instead, make it clear that it's a problem if someone else is doing it to them. It's a good idea to teach your child that if they ever feel uncomfortable with someone, even if nothing has happened, they can leave the room and tell their parent. They don't have to worry about being polite in this instance. They have to worry about protecting themselves. It can be hard to acknowledge for us as parents that even our children are sexual beings and are curious about sex and sexuality. Children's curiosity can lead to exploring their own body parts and each other's, other children's. They may peek when family members are in the bathroom or changing clothes. They may try to listen outside the bedroom door. They may look at magazines or books or something on the internet. It can be very hard to tell the difference between normal sexual behaviors and behaviors that are a sign that a child may be developing a problem. So sexual play that is considered typical and inside the normal box is between children who have an ongoing, mutually beneficial, a mutually enjoyable friendship. So this is not taking advantage of a new kid or someone they don't know, okay? They're friends. It's in the normal box if they are of similar size, age, and social and emotional development. Again, not taking advantage of someone less than them. Play between children should be lighthearted and spontaneous. They should be having fun. It shouldn't be, you know, scary and secret. And when adults set limits, for example, children keep their clothes on when they're playing, children should be able to follow those rules. Sometimes a child or a young person might engage in sexual play with a much younger or more vulnerable child, and that's not necessarily a sign of sexual aggression, but you may need some help figuring out with a professional if you have to do something to help control those impulses. So again, inside the normal box would also be playing doctor, a common childhood game because children are curious about their bodies and the bodies of others. It falls within the normal box. But you could say to them, if you want to play doctor, do it on your dolls. Do it on your stuffed animals. If you find them playing doctor, you should, you know, calmly say, it looks like you're comparing your bodies. Let's put our clothes back on. Remember, we play with our clothes on. So just not to freak out when you find these things, because curiosity is normal. So what is age appropriate? The next few slides are going to be broken down by age for the different ages. We have preschool 0 to 5 years old, what's common and uncommon. Basically, what's uncommon is any kind of specific sexual acts or explicit sexual language. What's inside the normal box for children of this age is curiosity about themselves and others. What's outside the normal box is, and more of an area of concern, is wisdom beyond their years when they know too much about sex. And any kind of oral sex kind of play would be considered out of the normal box. So to talk to your children in general, we want to talk early and often. We want to define difference in surprise and secret, teach them their body is their own. With this age group, you would teach them that nobody is to touch them in their private parts. Unless, and the buzzwords are clean, safe, and healthy, unless they're keeping in those three things. And you teach them that their private parts is anything covered by a bathing suit. The analogy is not perfect because someone can touch you inappropriately in places outside the bathing suit, like your neck or your mouth or your legs, but it's a good start. Since we know that in many cases where a child is sexually harmed, the child knows the adult, it's important to use examples and situations that make the reality clear to your child. The parents should give examples so you can spell it out clearly. You might say something like, sometimes relatives like grandparents or uncles or cousins don't understand the rules and touch kids in ways they're not supposed to. If that ever happens, be sure to tell me so that I can teach them the rules about touching, okay? But you've got to spell it out for your kids. When talking with children about touch, remember that sexual touch can be confusing. In a strictly physical sense, sexual touch can feel good, and for a victim of sexual abuse, this can make it even more shameful and confusing. A child might think, if my body responded this way, it must mean I like it. So many families prefer to talk about secret touch or touch that makes a child uncomfortable. The parent might say, it is not okay for anyone to touch you in any way that makes you feel uncomfortable. Not mom or dad or aunts or uncles or teachers or even your friends. Your body is yours and yours alone, and you always have a right to say no. In terms of spelling it out, I think the idea of explaining about tricks to your child at this age especially is really important, okay? We've talked about these adults who are grooming children, and they try to bribe them to keep from telling them. So we want to tell your kids, people are going to tell you that I won't believe you, or people might tell you that you're going to get in trouble, but they're just telling you that to trick you, okay? So that kind of arms them a little bit there. I am assuming that older children will have all of those same things already covered by the time they move on to the next slide. And we have a great brochure on the Peacemaker Center back there about talking to the 0 to 5 age group. Okay, and then we have the school age children. Again, what's common and what's uncommon? at this age, many children are ready to hear basic information about their on their level about sex and where babies come from. I encourage you to, you know, approach that topic with truth whenever they ask. And I stress again that you should be using proper body part names when you're talking to them. Sadly, 20% of children who experience sexual abuse are in this age group or under. It would be a good idea at this age to make sure your child knows what other adults they can confide in, right? If help them to realize that there are other adults who can help them if they don't want to talk to you or if you're not there. So you might play that, you know, ask them if you don't feel comfortable talking to me, who else will you talk to? Help them to think about who else they would talk to. Or maybe you'll even say something like, if something happened at the park, you know, who would you talk to? That kind of thing. And then you can help them with the answers to that too, in terms of some other people. And then we have the school-age children. Hormonal changes and external influences like peer pressure and media and the internet will increase sexual awareness, feelings, and interest for this age group at the onset of puberty. And so this is what's normal and common and uncommon. Some sources say that the average age of abuse for boys falls in this category. In this age group, many kids would just roll their eyes and discount their parents' discussion of, you know, some sort of version of talking about touching or whatever. So a good idea would tell you they already, you know, already know. They know, Mom, right? So for this age group, frame it as a talk about safety. And then instead of just you lecturing them, I recommend you play the what if game. Give them a chance to give you feedback. So you start with something like, you know, what if you got home and the house was locked and you couldn't get in? And then you might move on to, you know, what if a friend told you a secret and made you promise not to tell? And then what if someone threatened to kill your puppy if you told about something bad that he did to you? And then what if you were at a friend's house and her older brother asked you to play a game that makes you feel weird or uncomfortable or involves something like touching or taking off your clothes? So this is a really good approach for this age group because it's not just lecturing. And then we have the adolescents, common and uncommon. 66% of victims of sexual assault and rape fall in this age group. So parents talk to their middle schoolers and their high schoolers about drugs and about peer pressure, but not about sexual abuse. And remember, when we don't talk to our kids, they might read that as, this is something we just don't talk about. So we have to talk with them. You know, we need to talk with them about what to do when adults act inappropriately around them, especially people who are supposed to be guiding and mentoring them. So how can we initiate conversations with this age group? When you begin the conversation with your middle schooler or high schooler, first ask what they've already heard and then listen to what they tell you. Sadly, there are plenty of news choices to pick from. When there are stories on the news of teachers or principals or even teammates who sexually abuse someone, have the conversation. Seize the moment. Ask your child what they've heard and what they think. So, for example, you might ask them, do you think it's appropriate for a teacher to have a sexual relationship with a student? And then listen to them. Hear their thoughts. It's important that they feel their perspective is valued, and you'll know what you need to address in your response. We all have our own relationships to sex and how comfortable we are in talking about it. We all have our own relationships to our kids. You have to know your child. And maybe these conversations for you, you know, take place via email or via some videos or a book. There's lots of ways you can talk to them. There's not just one way. But remember, it's not just one conversation at the dinner table. It should be ongoing. For me, a great place to talk to my kids when they were in high school, middle school and high school, was in the car, right? Nothing like having them stare out the windshield to have a chance to talk to them when they're not looking you in the eye and don't want to look at you. So sometimes you might want to, actually, again, not talk, but maybe use email or books. The most important thing is for your child to feel comfortable coming to you with their questions and anxieties. If you speak openly with them about these difficult issues, they'll know they can come to you and talk about anything. Teach your kid to report inappropriate behavior. The best way to confront or prevent abuse is to report it, including when teachers or coaches or counselors act more like friends than authority figures, when they begin to violate boundaries. If your child sees or hears anything suspicious, they should tell you and a guidance counselor or another teacher. There's some great videos out. I really wanted to show a video tonight called Tea and Consent, about teaching about consent to this age group, the older kids. Highly recommend it. And it's a little lighthearted, so you can kind of watch it and then talk about it with your kids, especially your boys. No means no, right? So if you've never talked about your kids, about this with your kids, you know, this is the week to start. Instead of beating yourself up for that fact, I encourage you to be proud of yourself that you're here tonight and for taking this big step, and now go home and do it. Maybe tonight you can casually drop the fact that you came to a talk on sexual abuse and then look for opportunities in the coming week. Now that you know how to talk to your child and what to cover, what do you do if they come to you? So the first thing I want you to know is you need to watch what you say. The tongue is a small thing, but what enormous damage it can do. That's from the book of James in the Bible. You have to be so careful when your child, if God forbid, your child does come to you. I recently, a member of our family had an acquaintance that was recently roofied, which is given the date rape drug and then raped. And when she went home to tell her mother, the first words out of her mother's mouth were, "Well, you shouldn't have been drinking." You can't take those words back, right? It casts so much blame. One sentence can make a huge impact on how a victim sees themselves and the situation. One sentence can do a lot of damage. It is crucial that you think before you speak. It is never, ever the victim's fault. I don't care if they're walking down the street naked. Their body is their body unless they give someone permission to touch it. So if your child approaches you with this awkward conversation, this difficult conversation, you've got to listen. Start by asking questions and hearing your child. Don't make corrections or insinuations or express doubt. A simple, "Are you sure?" could be enough to shut them down. It could be enough of a hint that they're not going to be believed, that they won't pursue the conversation. So we were thinking about, like, what would filler be if your kid came and, like, dropped this big, you know, bombshell on you? I think you have to think about that and practice it. Teach yourself to say something like, you know, I don't know, "Oh no, how do you feel about that?" Or, "I'm listening, tell me more." Something to buy yourself some time to regroup. And you can practice those in the smaller moments, right? Like, "I forgot my project," or "I got cut from the team." Like, give yourself a moment to process and think before you respond. I'm a big believer in circling back. So you have a conversation and you say the wrong thing. You know, later you can reapproach that conversation. For some reason, people seem to think like, "Oh, I forgot to ask." Well, like, go back later and say, "I was thinking about that conversation we had, and I was wondering," whatever you're wondering. Or if you said the wrong thing, go back and say, "I was thinking about that conversation, and I said the wrong thing. Like, tell me more. I'm so sorry. Please forgive me." Apologize so that you can move forward. And then try to correct the situation through believing them and through empathy. So if your child approaches you with a conversation that begins with, "Promise me you won't tell anyone," don't promise. You have to say something like, "Honey, I can't promise until I know what you're going to say." Or you can say, "If someone's safety or health or well-being is at risk, it's my responsibility to act on it." I always say, "I promise you that if I'm going to tell someone, I will tell you. So I'm not going to act behind your back." But whatever you do, you've got to remain calm when your child talks to you. You don't want them to be sorry that they ever shared with you. So the point I'm making here is you've got to listen to your child. Try to be aware of those little hints. When you realize you've missed something, circle back and ask them later. Be very careful what you say. So I just wanted to touch ever so briefly on sleepovers as part of this. You know, some people would say that sleepovers are a rite of passage and completely normal. And then on the other hand, there's Dr. James Dobson from Focus on the Family says he thinks the day for sleepovers is over. Child abuse is so rampant today and so pervasive that you can't afford to run the risk. That's his quote. So you've got to decide what you want to do with your family, but you have to decide with your eyes wide open, right? I know from our family, my husband and I decided early on that we were not going to allow our children to do sleepovers. Eventually, they got the idea and they just quit asking. There were a few limited number of times they got to spend the night away, but it was usually because we were going to be out of town and we needed the help. We had a variety of reasons for that decision. When they were young, we felt like it was our way of protecting them from others. And when they got older, we thought it was our way of protecting them from themselves. So my husband would go and pick them up at midnight so they didn't miss too much of the fun and bring them home. But I think it's a subject you have to think about, knowing the statistics here. Now, I'm not saying this has to be your decision, but I will tell you of a bullet that my family dodged. So my kids were involved in this school project. It was about an hour away from our house, and they had to be there every day in this 1 week. And so there was this family who lived near the place, and I knew the mom from school. We were friendly, known them for years, good family. And the mom said, "Do you want to let your kids sleep over at my house, you know, so that you don't have to do the commute?" Well, it was easy for me to say no because we don't do sleepovers. So I said no. Well, years later, her husband was arrested and did time for sexually abusing their daughter. So, you know, for us, that was real affirmation that, you know, you just don't know what you don't know. So if you choose to go with sleepovers, here's a few things you might want to think about. And I know saying no to sleepovers is countercultural, but you have to do what you think is best for your family. So if you choose to do them, a couple of things to think about. You want to know who's going to be sleeping over that night, right? Is brother also having a sleepover? Do you know mom and mom's boyfriend and mom's and the girl's or the child's brother, you know, who's in the house, you've got to know. I recommend that you find out where they're sleeping. Like if they're downstairs in the big open space, that's probably a little better than, you know, held up upstairs. Want to speak with the family, find out who's supervising. The parents going out and somebody's babysitting, like what's the story and who's supervising your children? If you're uncomfortable asking those questions, you probably shouldn't allow your child to spend the night away. And then you need to make sure your child can call you. If they're too young to have a cell phone in their possession and to be able to reach you, then they're probably too young to be there. They have to be able to call you at any point in the night. And I promised you I wasn't going to tell you stories just to, you know, scare you. So, but there are a lot of them going with sleepovers. So I just recommend that your child would always be able to call you. And then the last thing that I don't have any time to talk about is pornography. It's a huge subject. It could be a whole evening in itself. Just make sure you talk to your children about it and make sure you teach them that if anyone shows them images of naked children or naked adults doing things that seem wrong, they should tell you. So to recap, and I know that was a ton of information, there are 5 important things that you want to share with your child. That you give them permission to forcefully say no to an adult or authority figure who is asking them to do something that makes them feel uncomfortable. That's kind of the buzzword there. Explain the difference between a secret and a surprise. A secret with an adult is never okay. You have to make sure they know that you will believe them, that you would never blame them, and you want to play that what-if game with them, just to make sure they understand what it's all about. And then these prevention tips are how to keep your child safe, and these are for you. Make decisions for your child based on the facts of childhood sexual abuse, not your trust in others. Minimize one adult, one child relationships. Be alert to the signs and symptoms. Act on your suspicions. Trust your gut. And again, believe your child. So if you remember nothing else, I would say remember that these conversations have to be ongoing and open and casual. You wouldn't tell your child just one time not to cross the street without looking both ways. So you would tell them over and over, and you would practice with them, and you'd make sure they get it. Well, it's the same for sexual abuse, except that you have this conversation from a much earlier age, and it changes as your child grows up. So in closing, I would say child sexual abuse is happening at an alarming rate. And I know this is disturbing, and you may be thinking of your friends or family and freaking out right now, and you are wondering who you can trust. You are worrying about how to protect your child. But part of that answer is to apply what you've learned this evening. Be alert and communicating. Communication is prevention. And I want you to consider that sexual abuse survivors can and do become healthy adults. I always tell my clients that you will never forget what happened to you, but you won't always have to suffer it. Survivors can recognize that their life experiences make them who they are. They can grow and get stronger because of them. Life is a journey. Some roads are harder than others, but they are always worth it. It's not about what happens to us in life, but how you react to it that matters. At some point in life, we have to recognize that life is beyond our control. We can do our part. We can teach our children. We can try to make wise choices. But at some point, we have to recognize that we cannot control everything. For me, I believe that we are in God's hands and we live in a fallen world, so bad things do happen. But He can use even the worst things for a person's ultimate good. I love the words of Isaiah 61. They apply perfectly to victims of sexual abuse. Think of these words in that context. So I've already referred to the fact that God can make beauty out of ashes. That verse says, "The Spirit of the Lord has come to comfort those who mourn, provide for those who grieve, and to bestow on them a crown of beauty out of ashes." That chapter goes on to say, "They, those who were once captives, will rebuild the ancient ruins and restore the places long devastated and restore the places long devastated for generations. So no matter what happened to you as a child or to your child, there is hope for rebuilding, renewing, and restoring. The good news is that the number of cases of sexual abuse seems to be dropping in recent years. And I think that's because of aggressive prosecution of offenders and prevention efforts like this tonight and a greater societal sensitivity to the serious problem. We shouldn't stop talking about it because that is the prevention. We're going to watch a short video.